Hello, welcome to the first panel of this year's Wizards of Oz conference. The panel will be always called Freedom Expanded. I'm very happy to have the privilege to open with the first panel of this conference, and I would like to thank the organizers, Volker Grasmuck, and all the others for putting together this event and giving us the privilege to go first. The space of freedom that can possibly be built using communication technology is by far not yet explored. We are still in the early days, but there are strong forces trying to regulate this space that we barely know, regulate it both to re-exert full control over the flows of information, but also, and that might be equally difficult, forces trying to establish early compromises on how we should think about this space with a progressive idea, but with a very compromising bent. In this first panel, we want to go into the wider expanses of possible freedoms. Freedoms based on radical openness, and we will be starting with the lowest level, the level of the network itself. Alexei Blinov will talk about this in his first presentation. Alexei has been active as a media artist for more than 20 years now, and he has started numerous innovative projects in this area, most recently the community project Consume in London, and he has been active from day one in the Freifunk project here in Berlin, and these days most of his time is taken up with developing Hive networks. Alexei is based in London. The second presentation will pick up on that. It will be Carmen Weisskopf and Thomas Molio, who are members of the Zurich-based media collective Bitnik. They will speak about their projects to hack television and to transform it into an open, decentralized network. And they do that at the intersection of community networks, like the one that Alexei is building, combined, fused with micro-broadcasting and peer-to-peer networks. The third and final presentation will be by Rasmus Fleischer from the Swedish Pirate Bureau. He's a trained musician and journalist, and he's currently working to turn peer-to-peer file sharing into a social movement. And that work, it seems, to be very successful right now. Propelled by the brute force, I think, of the giant BitTorrent tracker Pirate Bay, to which they are not really associated formally. He and his colleagues have managed to connect the practice of peer-to-peer file sharing that is done as an everyday activity of millions and millions of people around the world, to connect this mundane activity with issues of free speech and freedom of expression, and therefore turning this semi-clandestine activity into a proud act of civil disobedience. And this, starting in Sweden, this practice and these ideas seem to be catching on. So the first in Sweden itself, there's now, since a few months, a pirate party that looks to engage in kind of official electoral politics to promote freedom of speech and freedom of access to information and the right to privacy, things we have heard in the opening speeches, as central to a free information environment, to promote that through elections and parliaments. This idea has also, outside of Sweden, caught on quite a bit, and there are now pirate parties of various sizes in the US, in Austria, and since a few days ago, also in Berlin. As a sign of the growing appeal of this movement, of this attempt to simply do things and see where they lead, There's now also a documentary on the Swedish peer-to-peer scene, a film called Steal This Film, appropriately. And most of the filmmakers are here at the VOS conference, and the film will be screened, I think, tomorrow evening here. So in the next 2 hours, we want to explore the still largely unknown expanses of freedom. And these are not only unknown, but also untamed. So in these 2 hours, we'll freely cross legal and moral boundaries. Because what real freedom struggles are all about is redrawing exactly such boundaries. After the three relatively short presentations, we'll have plenty of time for an open discussion, to which I'm really looking forward to. So take the presentation as input or position statements for the discussion to which all of you are invited. So without much further ado, and I don't want to take any more time, please join me in welcoming Alexei Blinov.
Hello. I'm representing here a collective, or rather a collaboration, which is constantly growing, so it's quite hard to draw the boundaries around this collaboration, but however, we call it Hive Networks. In the present days, everybody is quite familiar with an abundance of emergent technologies and communication things, facilities, internet, computers, and the rest of the things of DSLs and broadband, all things like that. So all that bringing in a number of newly discovered cultural phenomena, such as publishing. However, all these new initiatives and all these kind of new advances and adventures brought forth a number of things which aren't really quite common or quite known, not very clear how to deal with it. So say most of the content which is published or say propagated across the networks, across the global networks, is somehow bound to the large globalized commercial publishers and content brokers, like news organizations, information collectors such as say APN, Reuters, BBC, Google, things like that. So they kind of taking control of large mass media corporations, which they are, and they try to kind of propagate their own idea as it used to be before, in the times, pre-internet times, pre-computing times, when the publishing was the privilege of a large, big corporate body, which need to have a large corporate machine in order to evaluate or somehow deal with the huge amounts of information and the huge amount of users of that information. We also have a large globalized commercial physical infrastructure owners, such as AT&T or say British Telecom, who owns all rights and kind of owns the physical means of physical communications. That's delivery vans, repairmen, people who are going up the poles and fix the antennas for the BT. Such kind of people. And on the other hand, we also have a large amount of individual, relatively poorly connected and quite naive users who are taking everything what is advertised around us on TVs and radios and in newspapers as a clear coin. So that would be the baddies, or rather strange kind of situations which came into kind of possession of this newly appeared medium, of this newly appeared culture, which isn't really quite formed. However, it does see the appearance of something which is, I wouldn't call scary, but maybe quite strange thing, such thing as an emergence of publishing culture, which is in opposition to the culture which has been before, suggests that the users may actually produce something back rather than be only on the receiving end of all these information streams. Hence, we can see the appearance of such events as peer-to-peer networking, such as the following colleague of mine is supposed to be presenting here, a Pirate Bay situation, right, which is an ultimate peer-to-peer network, so he'll probably elaborate on that matter. But nevertheless, from my perspective, peer-to-peer networking is quite significant in such a sense that it basically lets two individuals who aren't a publishing corporation of any description, but they actually communicate and publish something to each other. Shared network ownership. This is also a kind of newly emerging phenomena within this global information world, which also brings in very new things that basically challenge the global ownership of the infrastructure. So indeed, there is a number of initiatives sprung at least around Europe, which do kind of build the networks which aren't owned by any corporate entity as such, but rather owned by the people who actually build them. And such networks you can definitely see here in Berlin, and you can definitely observe in London and a number of other places and cities across the globe. But, well, I know more about the European stuff. Then we also can observe such a phenomena as, say, media sharing. You have all sorts of instant messaging. You have all sorts of such as, say, ICQ, Skype, people actually exchanging all sorts of information, which is their personal, with their personal parties. So again, we have a stream of information which is somehow avoiding or bypassing a corporate aggregator in one way or another. As well as, say, personal posting is also a very, very new world phenomena, but spread quite wide and large. You can see things like, say, YouTube, Google Video, and Flickr, and MySpace.com, and all sorts of things like that, when people actually start pouring the information, the content, which is basically their own, and they're kind of pouring this stuff into the network. So we definitely do see that there is some kind of publishing going on across the wide, really, really wide audience, which has been quite muted before. That actually leads to relevance of such extremes as the mesh network advancement. Mesh network advancement, which kind of found its spread specifically across Berlin. There is absolutely my favorite mesh network right here in this town. And I consider it's the biggest and the most advanced mesh network for, as far as I know. As recently we all kind of, well, I don't know about all, but as recently happened to be that plenty of small network and handheld units, as well as lots of small embedded devices actually running software such as Linux operating systems and stuff, becoming something what manufacturers of these devices never ever expected before. Right? Given the fact that this drives the price on the computing and networking devices right down to absolutely bare minimum. And these days you can purchase reasonably powerful network computer for around £50, which is quite cheap. I mean, it certainly kind of falls short of a $100 computer, which has been sold by MIT and IBM to the United Nations. But still, it's quite here. It's here, it's present. We're all in possession of at least a dozen of computerized devices. Even right now, most of you have in your pockets at least three or four, starting from your mobile phone and ending up with your watch, with your digital watch. Basically, each of these devices is a tiny little computer. The question is how far you can control it. So here we have a clash, a mismatch between corporate and kind of rather bulky and very heavy nature of superstructure which governs all these wonderful things and kind of tries to claim ownership of it. Not very successfully, I must say, but hence we have a mismatch, a clash between these two different areas where the people actually want to use this medium and trying to use it, and the ownership of the medium itself and the big operators of that medium. They don't really fit together quite well. Hence we have situations which are basically seems to be quite obscure, such as, say, censorship and capitalization on internet resources as such. say corporations, say like MSN, Microsoft Networks, or say Google, we all produce web pages, we all produce content, which Google claims as theirs, not in literal sense of, but in a sense of knowledge about my content is sold by Google, right? So say knowledge about my picture in Flickr is sold by Flickr. It's not mine anymore, it's Google's. It's not mine anymore, it's Flickr's, right? So in that sense, these big corporates can kind of control what sort of information travels where and who receives what. Because I'm not quite sure by which reasons and how Google actually decides which page is supposed to come at the first hit. They do have their own mechanisms. We're not going to go into technology because I'm quite aware of how most of the system works. That's not the point. The point is that they taking control over something which isn't strictly theirs. All right? Next thing is the appearance of the volume-charged internet. I don't know about Germany, but in England, certainly majority of the commercial high street service providers start producing the packages which are heavily, heavily volume charged, which means that you're going to be paying per byte. To me, that seems like they're basically trying to limit access of people to things which aren't theirs as well. It's like, I'm not quite so sure if the ISP in the position of those bits and bytes to be charging for it. Really. So I would rather say that is a kind of a mismatch between, say, my capability of producing large volumable media such as sound or a video and the internet service provider actually charging some customers for actually watching it. I'm not quite so sure that I like it. Next thing, we have an appearance of a pseudo communities. Because this global connectivity, although how nice and well-meant that thing is, however, it brings forth such a phenomena that localities ain't no matter anymore. It doesn't matter where you are. You could be in Hong Kong and be with the same community, claim the same community with somebody in Berlin, but you ain't real community, are you? You're actually living somewhere. You're living within some specific block in some specific town. You're not living at the same time in Malaysia and in California. You're living in a specific city. And that is totally lost with the global communications. So basically, hence, we can observe the substitution of real geographically and socially and historically formed communities with the communities which actually sprung just out of some bizarre work such as a gaming community. There's nothing wrong with that. However, it brings forth the situation when it's not real people who communicate, who can actually constitute a community, but rather avatars in whatever form and manner they are. Next thing, we do have definitely a loss of privacy. The privacy in respect of in relationships with what we have now is a little bit of a dubious thing. Since you have to rely on large commercialized infrastructure to provide you with the search engine, to provide you with a store engine, to provide you with the facilities to manipulate your remotely stored information, you basically surrender your right to your own stuff to somebody else. And what that somebody else is supposed to be doing with it is not up to you at all. Is nobody asking you. So hence, Google always knows what you're searching for. I'm not quite so sure if I would like Google to know what I'm searching for. All right? So, given all that, and spent quite some time looking into all this situation, we came with a number of dreams. So here I'm going to tell you what sort of parts of Hive dreams actually are. As an alternative, as suggested alternatives. First of all, we would like to have a democratic tools of networking and publishing as well, such as a variety of softwares, I'd rather say, and the platform, software platforms, such as Dynabolics, for example, such as wikis and things like that. We also would like to see the taking over of the whole connectivity range with the community-owned infrastructure, which is supposed to maintain a privacy stand from a perspective that everybody is a provider. We want to have individual information farming. So we want to see that individuals who actually produce information, produce content, actually taking care of it, nourishing it, and cultivating your own information sphere around you. That also relates to the shaping of your own information flow. It's you who are supposed to decide what sort of stuff you're going to see or what sort of stuff you're going to pass through. As well as we're obviously looking into the technological support for all this through the capability-aware networks and obviously capability-aware devices. So we actually did put some effort into closing onto that dreams and produce the following things. We kind of do almost full-time work on unleashing full potential of consumer devices. That is, we do quite a lot of hacking of tiny little boxes which you could buy in the high street shop for about £50 a piece. We do try to write a number of intuitive software tools, or so to say, perform de-geekification of a necessary means to actually make use out of all this stuff. We do engage with the media artists and active content producers in order to produce, gain some use, and to gain some example of usage of such devices and such networks, such environments. And we actually do participate quite extensively in a public network building. We also do quite a lot of research into mesh networking technologies and multi-tier networks, which again is a bit of a dubious issue. However, it seems to be very promising as such as a technology to have a multi-tier networking, which probably could be put to a very good use, as well as we do lots of experiment with the content advertisement. So if there is lots of Mac users around, well, but Mac users will recognize Apple Talk, well, dead so far, but mutated in ZeroConf lately. So that's basically what we're kind of trying to research and investigate in the Hive effort. We're also going to be putting a little performance, stroke, hacking session across these 3 days. And we're going to be based in a sea-based tent. So you're obviously welcome to come and join the scaled simulation of a macro environment and possibilities which opens up with development of the content gateways, and just explore cooperation of different networks, which are plenty around, and obviously make some fun, if anybody cares. That's the brief idea of what's supposed to be happening kind of around the situation as we see it right now. We're probably gonna have a number of static nodes which are gonna be shuffling content or from which you can be able to access content-centered networks. And a bunch of, four mobile devices, which you will also see on site because they're going to be mobile and they're going to be wired. And obviously, at the end of the whole story, I may humbly ask for help from the possible developers and pioneers of any technologies involved. So hence, we're kind of preaching unified effort for embedded platforms development. Development and research into content gateways and service discovery. Ability and opportunity awareness. That's probably related to the hardware development and the network protocol development. And basically, I can suggest that you will go get your Hive box, put the Hivewires on it, and get on with it. Thank you very much.
Are there any immediate questions to Alexei? Things you didn't understand, things you, acronyms you might want to get more information about. There's a microphone up here. I would like just to take questions kind of concerning basic understanding, because at the end we'll have plenty of time for a more general discussion. So everything was clear? Very good. It's a excellent sign for a presentation. Thank you very much. And now we'll move on immediately to the next presentation by Carmen Weisskopf and Thomas Mollier.
So, hello. My name is Carmen. This is Doma. We're from a media collective in Zurich called Bitnik, and we're engaged in the cultural and artistic production of software and installations. So we work in a more artistic sector. We use two strategies for our projects, basically. One is mapping and the other is hacking. And we would just like to explain shortly what we mean by this or what we do. What we call mapping is really the practice to try and illustrate mechanisms or systems, the way they work, and try to sort of explore into systems and see what else you could do with them. With hacking, we mean to then take these systems and try to, especially if they're closed, try to open them up for participation or find new ways to use them or take them somewhere else.
So basically, just to understand what we do, just a small presentation of two small projects we did. One is called the ASCII Soup. It was an intervention in 2003, which was an intervention at the WSES in Geneva, which was a conference from the UN about the information society, and they would speak about how to bridge the digital gap between the North and the South, between Europe and Africa, because in Africa they don't have easy access to technology, they don't have easy access to information, and this was our proposal, what we would provide, and it was it's called the ASCII Soup, and it's an educational daily ration. I mean, you can write programs with it, you can eat it, and you can learn the alphabet, and this is everything in one little box, and this is one thing. And the next thing we did is called People First. It's a software. It's a classical mapping software. And it produces web maps like this. Oh, it's a very bad picture quality, but I think you can see it. Actually, it shows the world according to indicators, which like here, it's a map about patents granted to residents, how much patents are there about per 1,000 people in a country. So here you see like Japan and Taiwan, they produce much more patents than Europe does or the US does. Yes, and because if a size is big, the country area, the size of the country would grow. And if something is small, the country gets smaller. So, and here we have another map, which shows personal computers in a country. Here you see the left side, there's North America is really big, and North Europe is really big. Germany is here, Switzerland is here, Africa is getting really small. And here you have Japan and Australia, which are also okay, but the rest of the world is really like stumbled together. India is somewhere here, and you don't even see it anymore. So this is just like a mapping, a visualization project.
The project we would like to talk a bit more about today is a project called CopyFight, or we call it CopyFight. This project came out of a series of TV hacking experiments we've done since 2004. We really started out to look at TV being a very closed and overregulated system, and we wanted to take what we knew as practices from the internet and just be able to do that with TV as well. So we wanted participatory communication structures, we wanted copy and paste, we wanted easy linking, we just wanted to use TV as we do internet. And we tried to find out how we could hack into this system and get it to open up to different practices. And we started off by building a very basic broadcasting system. You can see the antenna and the broadcasting system. And we, the aim there was to really do it DIY, to use materials we could find in shops or on whatever, wherever. And we organized some workshops around this. You can see that here as well. And we just tried to share this knowledge. Anything we have found out about building broadcasting systems, we would put into workshops, show other people. That was sort of the starting point to Copy Fight. Mm-hmm. Copy Fight basically is a participatory model for television. We adopted the principle of micro TV systems. You probably know from Telestreets in Italy, for example. So we were looking for a very low range broadcasting system. It was never the idea to like cover the city, but to have various small broadcasting systems. And the idea was to just directly link up the TV broadcasting system to peer-to-peer networks. You have endless content there. If you do the editing online, anyone can participate, and you can collectively run this TV station. So people can just download films, put them into playlists, get them running on the broadcast system, and watch them at home.
So basically, the Copy Fight system is something like a hybrid between television and the internet, and it asks about the what effect file sharing has on TV. We mainly work with found footage content. That means content that is around in which we find on the net, which we find in peer-to-peer networks, and put it in our playlist. And the whole thing is organized by a service system. Here you see like one picture where the people can edit the playlist. Yeah, when which movie should be showed. So the user decides on our website which content gets into the archive, because you can search the web for movies or peer-to-peer networks for movies on our website. And afterwards he also says what and when it's going to be played. So we have like from a do-it-yourself production, content production, our project is more like compose it yourself. Yeah, we don't produce any film material. We just use film material we find on the internet, or if we produce something, we publish it also on the net. Yeah. So and the reductional. This is like a view from the TV. It's reductional work which brings the people together. So you have to search for movies, you find movies, you have to archive them, you have to set the topics, and at the end you have to release them. And the release is the broadcast on the TV screen. So our goal was to work with common technology and to open up something like a new media space, which wasn't there before, because it's something strange. It's like a hybrid, and the problem is the origin of the content, because differentiation between content which is free or which is restricted is not really possible for us, because we just the films or movies in peer-to-peer networks, they don't say where they come from or under which license they are. So we just take them, and our system translates this wild mess and the problematics of copyright and in the internet to the television. Yeah, we have the same things there now, because everything is accessible. Yeah, you have like the same problems on TV too. So basically, this is how our system works. Just a small setup here. You have the user who sits at the computer at home, who fills, who searches, who archives, who does the playlist. And he communicates with our server, which is connected to peer-to-peer networks and the web. And he also feeds the broadcasting machine, which is broadcasting in a small local area. Like we have like a range for 500 meters or something. And yeah, this like a whole thing, like how it works. And maybe come.
We've been using Copyfy mainly in festival or exhibition contexts, so it's not been running full time. We've always set it up in different places, used it for a week or two, and really the idea was really to experiment with the format and see where it takes us. We are currently working on a stable version of the software, which really means to rewrite it all, and we would really like to set it up with a few co-ops in London, mainly Boundless Co-op, which is a network of WLAN connections, really. And there we would really like to have, on every WLAN node or wireless node, we would really have like to have a small pirate TV station and have one server for them all to jointly run the TV station together. Mm-hmm. The software is 100% open source and yeah, can be downloaded and maybe soon. we have sort of forked the project. This is just a small, to finish off, small project we've done in the past 3 weeks. It's just gone online 2 days ago. It's called Download Finished. It also really started out from Copyfight. We took the same peer-to-peer search client and the same automatical download machine, but here we would like to produce a more cinematic format, not TV, but connected to screenings. And the idea here was really to take these films from peer-to-peer networks and make them into new originals. So really take them, transform them, and re-release them as with a new author, with as a new original. The transformation we've done is really based on an encoding error. So we've taken out the keyframes, which means that the movie sort of goes blurish and has a really strange effect. And yeah, we run the movies through this machine. So you can also come as a user to the website, download the movie, run it through the machine, and re-release it as your own. That's the idea, basically.
So, yes. So maybe we can just show a small example of it, of the first movie we did 2 days ago. And it's a movie we found on the net, which is produced by our friends platonic.net, which will have a presentation
at three
about this project. And we have just taken this movie and produced a new artwork out of it. So it's just the files here are, the length of the file is compressed into 5 minutes. So the original movie goes a little bit longer, but this one is just like the web version. Our machine also produces like this intro credits and stuff, and they're like the film name is always the file name, burnstationen.rgm. It's directed by me. Thank you.
mobile copying station of free distribution music and audio. It is software and a local network, but about that revolves around people listening, selecting and copying audio files with copyleft license. Our pragmatic goal is to enable the listeners to edit audio compilations within a legal context and... For us, it is the social factor that ensures a dynamic reception, converting peer-to-peer and net. In fact, the slogan we use the most is taking internet. We have set up burn stations, galleries, in homes, in square. And permanent local burn stations exist or have been set in Sevilla, Barcelona, and Super. Reception becomes distribution, and as everything else, sporadic exchanges according to a gift economy logic.
So, thank you very much, and yeah, over to Robin.
Are there any immediate questions to Doma and Carmen? If not, I have one that you might briefly expound on this idea that every, you know, within the distributed network, every node of the network becomes also a broadcasting node. Can you tell us a bit more about what this is? And
You're referring to the project planned in London. Yeah. Well, the idea was really to, or let's say, with the range of only 300 to 1,000 meters, there's always a small group of users who can only involve in this copy fight system because all the others can't receive it. So, I mean, they can still edit the playlist, but there's no point because they can't watch TV. And so we sort of had the idea together with James Stevens from Boundless Co-op to distribute the signal not only over TV but also over the internet. So to stream through these nodes, stream one TV output signal, so to say, and then have TV stations at the other end, picking up the signal again and redistributing them to the city. So you then get not one pirate TV station, but let's say 15 for a whole area, and you sort of get to cover the area without having to increase the TV signal, but by using the internet streaming signal.
Question, does that make the individual kind of components of the network much bigger or much more expensive? Kind of the routers?
Not really. The problem is a bit that as we have the setup at the moment, you would need another extra computer. Yeah. And that is sort of not the idea. The idea would be to really have a TV out called basically running on the node itself to really plug into the broadcasting system. We haven't really resolved that problem.
Okay. Then thanks again. And we move on immediately to the next presentation by Rasmus Fleischer from the Swedish Pirate Bureau.
Thank you.
Hello?
Right.
Okay. I don't know how much you have heard about the Swedish situation and so on. Piratbyrån is our group. We started 3 years ago, almost exactly. The idea was at first just to make some kind of project around piracy, copyright, copying, peer-to-peer networks, as we had a feeling that that was something that would produce larger conflicts for several years ahead, but we didn't really realize how big it would be, I think. So we started with this project, making mainly news reporting and participating in public discussions. So that's the central activities we've been doing all the time, along with different events, parties, lectures, pranks. It's not that kind of traditional organization based on a set of programs. We have no official program and we don't recruit members, even if we might have the image of that kind of organization sometimes. And we have this web community with around 60,000 registered people and some kind of undefined swarm of people taking part in different practical projects around us. But if we're talking about the core, the smaller group of people that are really running Piratbyrån, we come from quite different backgrounds. Some comes from the areas of hacking, others from the art scene, activism, music scenes, or whatever. And I think that's what has made the whole project fruitful. This combination of perspectives that has enabled it to be also a learning process, because it's not only about giving a view that we have from the beginning, but continuously learning about from each other, from our friends and from our opponents, and understanding what lies on the bottom of the contemporary copy fight conflicts. So, well, strange the slide on the way. Okay. So sometimes we pair as a think tank, another day something else, some art project or activist group. It's a bit hard to say, and I think that has been a strength, because no one really knows what we are. But we do try to make it quite clear that we are not representing consumer interests in any way. That's not the position we like to be in. And we do not either represent file sharers in general, even if it's natural that when Swedish mass media wants the file sharer opinion, they usually call us and we give it to them, which wasn't happening, of course, before we started this. So that was the first influence in public debate about this. And now we also got into more and more international collaboration. We started the pro-piracy lobby as some kind of umbrella for that, propiracy.org. To many, I guess, Piratbyrån is mainly known as the founders of the Pirate Bay, the world's largest BitTorrent tracker. We started it some months after Piratbyrån was started, just as an experimental activity, how it would be to run a BitTorrent tracker. Then it grew very fast after crackdowns on other BitTorrent trackers. So then it was natural to branch it off. Today, the Pirate Bay is a separate entity, but we, of course, have very, very close and friendly relations to them, but we're doing quite different things. So at the end of May this year, there was this major clampdown on the Pirate Bay and like 200 other websites, including Piratbyrån, that happened to be on the same web hosting. What happened was that police were seizing quite large parts of the world's file-sharing infrastructure somehow. And it took like 3 days and it was up again. This is like how internet traffic in Sweden was affected. That started a very hot summer for us, a very fun summer. Just a couple of days after the raids, there was demonstrations in the larger cities in Sweden, participations from also from established political parties from the left and from the right and whatever. And it immediately turned on this debate that has been raging in Sweden. And it's also election year, so every politician feels compelled to say something about piracy and file sharing. And they try to do it in a way that is positive to file sharing, but they don't really know how to do it. Well, what's been happening is what happened quite directly after those raids was was that it got public that there was U.S. lobbying or MPAA lobbying with the help of U.S. government behind the raids, and that's a story that is going on right now. It was last week known by public television that the government denies to make public 700 mails between themselves and the U.S. government only regarding the Pirate Bay, which is a bit strange, as they said they would put everything on the table to make everything clear. So there is something they don't want to talk about. And it will be, the debate will go on for sure. And as Felix said, there has been this film made by some people in this room and others called Steal This Film. It's an ongoing project. We've got be several parts, but the first part is about the Opium and Pirate Bay and Swedish peer-to-peer activism. Well, so nowadays it's commonly held in Sweden that this peer-to-peer activism that somehow started with the Opium 3 years ago has influenced Swedish political discourse a lot. So this summer, it got mainstream topic in politics, and politicians that last year voted for harder copyright laws now turned 180 degrees, speaking out against criminalizing of unauthorized file sharing. So it's very, very hard to pin down where everyone stands right now, and that's a situation I think we like quite much. As you might know, and as Felix said, there has also been this year's the founding of a pirate party in Sweden. It wasn't founded by us in any way. It was completely different people, and they work in completely different ways. But they're focused on the national elections held this Sunday. Anyway, they organized something like 9,000 people, and their politics has been part of the pro-piracy peer-to-peer activist discourse that we established during these years. And so also they have been focusing on file sharing not as a consumer concern, but as something productive, and adding a strong emphasis on the consequences of what really happens when one tries to implement copyright in the digital realm. So, but we are not a lobby reforming or abolishing copyright. We're not really working with legislation in that ways, even if we're always happy to give feedback to politicians who are calling us and asking how they should understand all these matters. So we try to shape the public discussion in ways that it keeps on boiling, I think one could say, by escaping some common re-territorializations or dead ends or early compromises that the criticism against copyright law otherwise might tend towards. So one of these traps we try to escape is the consumer centrism, the stupid downloadism that you talk about, downloading as an activity separate from uploading. And so we have been really pushing for pushing the whole discussion towards talking about file sharing as a horizontal activity. Pushing it away from the stupid ways of talking about file sharing only as a response to high prices and so on, and instead talking about the different architectures that different cultural forms can live and flourish in. And also, there has been, from politicians this year, demands for some kind of a flat rate solution, as it's called in Germany, or alternative compensation system, that we haven't been like polemizing against it so much that we have been questioning the very categories that discourse is based on, pointed at the impossibility to identify a class of authors that should be compensated, attacking that idea that there are a group of people that are the authors that we can give some money to. And now, 2 months after, directly after the Pirate Bay raid, lots of politicians said things in that direction. We should legalize file sharing and compensate the authors. And we asked, who are the authors anyway? And now, 2 months later, almost all the politicians have dropped that idea. But they still are critical against the criminalization, but they don't really know how. But, well, anyway, I think it's, to some extent, it's we try to escape the hype for big news. Because big news all too often functions as misleading maneuvers in this copy fight. So below those dramatic big news, we try to work on the more conceptual level and influence how this is talked about, how the permanent crisis of copyright is masked by images grounded in a one-way mass medial logic, images that are black and white with no room for grayscales. So, So we try to take the position that copying is a fact. It's not something that we can discuss for or against. Copying is a fact. And it's very important to remember that copying is not dependent on peer-to-peer. It takes place anyway when the information is digitalized. So the alternative to peer-to-peer piracy is person-to-person piracy rather than no piracy. And what person-to-person piracy means is rather not less piracy, but less pluralism. That the sources of information tend to be more limited. A larger top-list culture and less long tail, or what you would like to call it. So the very concept of what do we mean with copying or piracy is something that we try to undermine. Because in digital environments, it's totally unclear what copyright law means with copying. It can only be some kind of metaphorical common sense reasoning, as it has to distinguish between local data transfers and file sharing between different systems, which isn't always very easy, and it's getting harder and harder, which is something, a very interesting development that is undermining the fundamentals of copyright. This is something that Magnus from Drapion sits here, formulated like three key points in the crisis about the definition of copying, about the the institutionalization about of consumers and producers, and about the content. The word content is also something very much worth questioning, of course, and something that we, I think, we do quite hard. So, if digitalization means somehow that these concepts are getting harder to pin down, it opens up for gray zones. Gray zones can be both have positive and negative meanings, of course. The clampdown on Pirate Bay, or the whole state of emergency that the war on piracy is waged as, could be seen as a negative gray zone, while the positive gray can be, for example, defined as all the music and film and files that are not very easy to say if it's like juridically white, like a penguin Creative Commons licensed or whatever, or totally black, like the 0-day blockbuster release. The copyright industry really wants discussion to be held in these black and white terms, while we try to talk about the gray zone in between in different ways. So in this technological turbulence that is caused, we all have to navigate with the help of language, and by creating concepts, but even more by reusing pre-existing concepts. So at the bottom of the copy fight lies certain metaphors. We have like the for example, when copyright lawyers or industry talking about streaming and downloading as it was two different activities. It's grounded in a totally metaphorical thinking, equalizing it with record selling and radio broadcasting. While we try to push for the fact that the only difference is in the software configuration at the receiving end. So with these metaphors, highly unstable metaphors at the ground of the copy fight, upon them is built a higher and higher building, the copyright law projects. And that is somehow a way to see the whole situation. So while we of course organize somehow around copyright and criticizing copyright, we really try not to give generalized answers for what the alternative is. Because that would mean to talk about things in the totalizing view, the totalizing way of thinking that copyright means. So maybe when we, for example, talk about economics of culture, we don't want to take it from that direction at all, but from the other direction, from the other end or other ends, because we should be highly. It's very dangerous to give those easy solutions about how all cultural producers should make their living or such things. So if we are, there are very on the one side of this problem we have copyright law and its concepts falling apart. On the other hand, we have the plurality of ways of cultural productions that should not be pushed into one alternative, I think. So we were asked here to say something about our visions, and it's a bit hard, I can admit that. And we often might answer such questions in a bit avoiding way, I think. But that's because we think that the copy fight is about making room for the unforeseeable. And we like to admit that there are technocultural complexities beyond the human capacity to compute. So talking about the future can be a trap. And it's a widely used rhetorical trick from the copyright industry to put these questions as if they were about something totally untested. But file sharing is not the future. File sharing is now. And what's utopian is rather the dangerous idea of a perfectly working copyright economy, of a world where culture equals content. So maybe that is what our vision is about going beyond the dangerous idea of cultural production of content, that culture is production of content, and trying to make those words unusable, and therefore forcing us to rewrite the map according to the terrain instead of the reverse, which is what copyright law is often about. So one part of the vision is definitely to separating the concepts of creation and creativity from the total focus on end products, and instead talking about the performative aspects that are always forgotten when we talk about it from the copyright side of the problem. We have our Danish friends in Pigatgruppen have performed recently a large research project with data from the collecting agencies in Denmark about music economics and digitalization, showing very clearly how the incomes from the performing aspects of music have almost doubled at the same time as record sales almost halved. So that kind of developments are totally interesting and something that we want to talk about. Because the shift from end products to performative based economics does imply a greater plurality generally. So but as I said, we don't try to do it as the great solution. We could try to give more solution, but we try not to, because the general statements about the alternative to copyright brings the danger of strengthening its universality claim. So somehow our ambition is to actively avoid the temptation of giving easy solutions and rather keep the gray zone wide and open to make room for understanding all kinds of cultural production from on their own terms instead of from copyright law's terms. And that's what we all the time tries to do. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Rasmus. Are there any immediate questions to Rasmus about understanding or requests to clarify something? Is there any? I don't really know how the microphone is organized. I think you have to come down here. It's all the way down here, so that we all see you.
Hi, my name is Alek Tarkovsky from Creative Commons Poland. I just would like a bit of clarification at the very end. I didn't really understand when you say that the concept of culture is not about production of content, that that's the wrong idea. Do you just mean what you said a bit later, that performance should replace production of content, or is there something, because I kind of didn't get it.
General claim about performance replacing content, but we see a danger in talking about in equalizing culture and content, and that equalizing it is being done all the time. and that is totally misleading. So in some aspects of culture, of course, there is a tendency where performative parts are taking back its role that it had before, that it somehow might have lost a bit in the last century. But it's not something, we don't make that general claim for all kinds of culture, because that would mean, again, talking about defining culture as copyrighted content, I'm afraid. So it's just a part of it. Should we start the discussion?
Yeah, I can try to pick up on something that was either explicitly or implicitly in all three presentations. One was this idea that you really cannot distinguish between the producer and the consumer, be that on the level of network, be that on the level of TV programming. And I think part of the project is, or at least one of the ideas that I read about the project in London is also to connect it to projects where people individually tell local stories and add them to this mix of global file sharing films and locally produced things. Again, in creating hybrids that don't really conform to our ideas. Okay, this is Hollywood, this is me, but kind of mix that up. And the same when you say that uploading and downloading artificial distinctions, that you know this is a horizontal peer-to-peer, as the name says, activity. So there is one idea about this dissolution of kind of very basic categories upon which we organize kind of culture. At the same time, there's this kind of interest, I think, underlying all of these projects in defining architectures, kind of actually working practical physical or informational architectures that would promote a different, even if we cannot really name those alternative categories rather than consumer and producer, which we know so well, but would promote different types of behavior, maybe. So maybe we can ask each of you to say something or comment on this connection between a particular type of architecture and the roles, social roles that it enables or constrains.
Well, the whole objectives of the Hive Networks project is to devise the technology which may propel such ideas to a height of a really functioning system. So hence certainly the investigation of architecture and combination of an architecture with the culturology which sits behind it is absolutely seminal, is fundamental. So certainly that's the basis upon which the Hive Networks is actually functioning, right? But trying to provide the technology in the first place.
I think also in the copy fight system, at least, it's really important to take apart, or for us it was very important to take apart the architecture of television. When we started out, also a lot of people always said to us, you can't just do television, because television always seems to be something very costly, very complicated, lots of material. You have to be a specialist, and everything is organized around this one person. And it was, I think for us, it was very interesting to be able to just break that up and to meet up with people who had done projects in that area as well, and to think, to really... to look at television as maybe a cultural communications form, and really take it apart and put the pieces back together and see where we could modify the architecture.
Ja,
Well, I think we shouldn't try to imagine a world where everyone is as much producer as anyone else or something like that. There is no use for such thinking. I mean, it's not something that lies ahead as much as something that lies in the concept we use and in the language that copyright and file sharing is debated in, and of course also in the very powerful economic structures of collective compensation systems. So it's more like adjusting concepts and language and those economic structures to reality than about putting up some grand vision about how we need to break down the barriers, because they are already to some extent erased. So if we take away the concepts that makes us think that those barriers still are there, then we can see what happens. And I don't know what.
We will get from John Henry, and a man of the beautiful man which was blind, Chauvinant wurde.
Are there any? At this point, we can either continue the discussion here on the panel, but we have a bit of time to kind of get at the and involve the expertise of the people in the audience, or to kind of overcome the architectural hurdles of this particular setup and try to make it a bit more kind of participatory at the discussion. So if anyone feels interested in jumping in, please do so. Rishab.
Hey, I'm Rishab Ghosh. There's this wonderful ironic comic book series produced by WIPO that explains why different types of intellectual property are absolutely essential, and it's geared at children. It's produced by an agency in Peru, of all places. So the comic book about copyright starts with a boy of, it's all multi-ethnic, so it's a boy of some mixed ethnicity whose parents are scolding him because he has his guitar and he wants to be a musician. And this smart girl who's been trained by WIPO tells him, well, you know, you can be a musician and still earn a living, because his parents don't want him to play music and earn a living. So the girl explains to him how, thanks to copyright, he can do what he wants to do and still survive. So I think the problem with this avoiding talking about what an alternative could be is that it is extremely easy to, you said that being asked to talk about this is a trap, but then not talking about this is really falling into the trap, because what you have then is that the WIPO comic book essentially poses the problem. Either you can't, your children can't play the guitar, they have to become bankers if they want to earn a living, or they need copyright. And so that it in fact, I think you're digging the hole deeper rather than escaping from the trap. And so you need to be able to say something about it, or try to show something that that people can see is a way for this sort of production to still happen.
Yes. What I mean is that it's a trap giving one answer for all kinds of cultural production. Answers should be given, or...
What?
Yeah, answers can be given, but it's very hard to give one answer that should be valid for all categories that are somehow affected by copyright, including architects and musicians and journalists and illustrators and everything. And that's a trap. Instead, we should give different answers for different categories. Maybe not even one answer for all musicians, but there are different musical scenes, different types of musical cultures that have their own cultures. And that demands a bit more of time, I must admit. But it's a trap. Giving one answer in one sentence for how everyone that has at some time had some economic connection with copyright economy should make their living in the future. That is what I mean.
Peter Jenner from the IMMF. I mean, I've made my living indirectly from the copyright industry, so I'm a guilty man. I just would like to make one or two observations. First of all, Alexei mentioned YouTube and MySpace, which I think is very interesting. MySpace is generating something like $1.5 billion a year in advertising revenue and is not paying anything to any of the people who are providing what is being put on MySpace and YouTube. I think if we do adopt a position where we don't expect to get any form of compensation for creators, people are going to come along and work out how to exploit them. And that is what's going on, and I think that is the issue. In that context, I think to say who are the authors is an incredibly useless observation, if I might say so, Rasmus. I think what you're doing is really interesting. But we do know there are authors. I know it's difficult to define who are the authors. I think we just have to do the best job we can do. The idea that there is some form of way of compensating people within a context where money is being made, whether it's by the telecoms people, whether it's by the electricity companies, whether it's by advertisers or whatever, there is money running through the system. And I think we should be looking at how we can make sure that some of that money does go back to creators. By all means, let's have a very much more dynamic view of the difference between the consumer and the producer. Let us try and loosen up the bonds, which says you're either a producer or you're a consumer. But let's not put that back into a different system where we are all consumers and producers. I don't want to be a producer. I'm a consumer. I don't want to do cut-ups of music. I'm very happy for people to do it, and I think we should work out how that can occur, but I don't want to do it. I just want to see the finished works. I'm passive in that respect. So there you go. Don't destroy the blanket license. I mean, I think the blanket license is something, or you called it something different, but it's the same thing, this sort of global license on a very moderate rate, maybe a way of finding an intermediate solution which compensates the creative people to go on doing their creations. And I think that to say just who are the authors as a reason for not doing it, it's very much like the sort of tactics the multinationals use. The multinationals have a tactic which is called embrace, extend, extinguish, which means you say, that's a terrifically good idea. Now I'm going to raise all the difficulties that can come up and blind you with difficulties, make it impossible to reach an agreement, thereby getting rid of the solution, thereby leaving them in power. So that's just a thought or two.
Some short words. When I say who are the authors and that is a question that must be put, I do not say there are no authors. But if we keep on equalizing authors with people who expect copyright incomes and maybe not get what they want to, then it's a very strange definition of authors. And talking about collective compensation systems of different kinds, if we should have a collective compensation systems for authors whose so-called content is multiplied on the internet, then we must confront what kinds of authors we do mean. If we mean copyright holders, then we must be able to stand up and say, yes, we want to put a tax that finances pornography. And fine, but stand up and say that then. And we must say, we must be able to stand up and say, why should we not give money to every blogger whose content is copied on the internet? Because it's totally unreasonable why people whose music is copied should have money, but not people whose text are copied in that way. So that's we must confront the question of who are the authors, and the answer cannot be that easy that the collective compensation system proponents want it to be.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not so much into real publishing, and I basically believe that the whole definition on the authors and consumers is a little wrong. I wouldn't be even attempting to define who is author and who is consumer. From my perspective, the whole story kind of basically based around the following situation. You're either on a network, either you're not. It's just as simple as that, as far as I'm concerned. If you're on a network, you are a part of a network. You are the network. You are the net. By just simply having your mobile phone, you are and producer and consumer at the same time. And I would frankly be very quite scared to split your mobile phone into microphone and a speaker. Yeah, and I haven't ever seen that anybody actually did it for any good purpose. So to me, basically having a network, being a participant of a network implies being a participant of a network. Hence, the very concept of producer and consumer simply becomes redundant and just ceases to exist. So this definition ain't valid no more. I may just remind you of a simple, very simple fact. Let's say after London 7-7, that's last year, yeah? If you remember all the terrorist activities in London about a year ago, the BBC site put actually, instead of news, right, on the front page, basically a bunch of video clips which were taken by the people's phone, by the people who actually been in the tunnels and stuff. Right? How would you call that? Who are those people? They are producers. I doubt. They mostly were kind of white-collar clerks from the city and kind of, you know, shopkeepers and stuff who was kind of rushing to their destinations or whatever, workplaces and stuff. However, in a fraction of a split second, they all become producers straight away. So I don't think the producer and the consumer in this respect is a valid definition. It isn't no more. You are the network. You are the net. Own your own network.
Perhaps if I may add something. I don't think the question is, or at least it doesn't appear to me that the question is whether we all produce this all the time. The question seems to be whether we are within a communication environment that enforces these rules very strictly, or whether it's our own choice, whether in this case we want to behave like a consumer, which I like to do from time to time, and in another case I want to behave like a consumer. So the question is not whether these roles don't exist, but whether these roles are strictly defined by the communication environment we're living in, or whether these are roles that we decide whether we want to take on at any one point. And if we see that as a continuum, yesterday in a workshop, there was an interesting comment by someone with a 16-year-old boy who samples music and does his own hip-hop. And he said, sampling is his way of listening. So he probably, yeah, he produces music, and maybe he wants to become a musician at one point in his life, but it's something much more fundamental. It's not a career choice, but a way of listening. And it's a choice to say, okay, now I take this and I take this, rather than having to accept all these things offline, and their only relationship you have to them is as a consumer. Just basically whether the relationship to culture is one of individual choice or one of enforced behavior. That strikes me as a more kind of adequate way of phrasing this, rather than do I have to sing my own music now?
I also think we got to stop idealizing production so much. It isn't something good, inherently good or fine or beautiful with production and producers. It can be bad and it can be good.
Yes, I have two comments. One I would like to add to this discussion. You said a moment ago when the BBC opened for a moment their system, they all became producers, and then you added that there's this issue of the technology allowing choice, but it wasn't them all. It was probably maybe, I don't know, 300 or 1,000 people sending it, but not all, you know. We have Wikipedia, right? Wikipedia screams at you, edit. We can assume the interface is a bit broken because there's so much going on, but there's edit, edit, edit everywhere. And for instance, on Polish Wikipedia, you have about 500 editors a month and 3 million consumers. So the producer gene is among, like, you know, genes for the rarest diseases. So I think when you look at choice, you still have to look at that people don't make the choice. And now it's a question, maybe you need education for cultural production. Maybe they've been brainwashed, but otherwise we get stuck at some technological deterministic mode that you open the channel and they all become producers. So I would agree with the man who spoke that the author is a position that's specific. Though I understand your doubts about the compensation system. I think one solution that's been proposed is a producer's co-op, where you have to become a member of the co-op and only the content from the co-op. And then the consumer kind of makes an agreement with the co-op and not with the authors at large. A cooperative.
Would that compensate bloggers, yes or no?
If they join the cooperative, yes. If they decide they want to be compensated for their content, and then the consumer has the right to say, I don't want to pay for this cooperative that funds bloggers. That's one thing. And the other, I wanted to ask you people from Beatnik, because you said that you're into mapping and hacking, and I'm all for it. And I saw it in your projects, but to be honest, when we're talking here about extension on freedom, I have more problems seeing that. And so I would like to maybe just ask you how you see your work as doing that, because for instance, your last project, it muddles for me the work of the artist. I wouldn't feel comfortable being called a director of something where I just added some noise. I wouldn't really feel like taking it. I can see it as hacking, but it doesn't add for me anything to this whole idea we have of open culture, free culture, or whatever. I'm not sure I understand. So maybe I'm just missing something.
Yeah, maybe we also look at the issue a bit differently in a certain way, because as producers, as artists, we firmly and very, very strongly believe that we are absolutely dependent on a cultural environment. Nothing we do comes out of the genius of our group. That's the problem maybe we have with when we talk about authors. I think all, like, different people who have spoken now, they mean something different with it. But for me, for example, there is not this one genius artist that the modernist that goes into the forest and comes up with all these ideas. All we do is listen to other people, see what's going on, use that. That gives us ideas, and we start to produce. And I, in that sense, really want to pose the question of what exactly are we copywriting? Because, yes, you can use samples, and with the sample you can see that it comes from somewhere else, but there's a lot of ideas that just circulate, and it's always been like that. And I just, this idea of having an original, especially in, or talking about digital material, is just totally absurd in a sense. And I think we do mean that author, I mean, to be the director of your own movie as a sort of ironic add-on in a certain way, it's not, you know.
Yeah. Hello, my name is Martin Springer. I'm from the Digital Media Project, which works on specifications for interoperable DRM platform. I'm critical about DRM. My remark is that I see that you have different definitions of the net. The definitions are not technically, but they are on what you can do in the net. And I just want to say that it seems that it is a fact that at least in the consumer electronics industry, there is more and more DRM. So on the assumption that DRM will be a reality, I'm asking myself what exactly will be the reality for the users. And I think that you said, Rasmus, you said communication environment. I think this is a good word for an environment or a system where certain rules exist, and these rules are agreed on by the users. So I think that different environments will coexist next to each other in the net. And for me, I think it is important that the users do not need different devices or different network providers or different service providers to access the different environments. So for this reason, I claim that it is necessary to work on standards for so-called interoperable DRM platforms, where the rules in the platform are open to the users. And of course, there are many requirements, like it must be open source, it must be free of software patents, and so on and so on. So this is for sure. This development may not be controlled by corporate entities or governments, but this is more or less requirements. I just want to say that I think it's important to design a system where different communication environments can coexist.
Oliver.
I'm Oliver Moldenhauer, active in the Fair Sharing campaign in Germany. And I liked a lot about what Rasmus was saying, especially the gray commons part, and not the gray commons, but the idea that gray areas are important. And I have to admit that you're far more successful in getting the issue in the public in Sweden than we are in Germany. But I'm still very tempted to point out that on the one hand, you're saying don't go for the one solution. And if there's a solution presented for one part of music, which is like the recorded, where you buy music, ready-made music, by some kind of alternative compensation system, then you try to force every problem on it. So it should compensate for bloggers, yeah? Probably also should compensate for software and so on. No, but I think this is just one part of a whole set of solutions. Doesn't help anything with performance, doesn't help a lot with how do you improve sampling, but it could be something where people who make a living on selling ready-made music can have an alternative. And I think that that you underestimate the political power of alternatives, even if it's just for a very small point. It can be so important. We saw it with the alter-globalist movement, where the Tobin tax, which is actually not like the big change of the whole world at all, but just the existence of one concept for a very small part of the global economy was so important to encourage activism. And if you don't have this, then there's always danger that you have now a really cool summer and people see it's a big problem, but after half a year or a year of discussions, yeah, it's a big problem, but there's no other way. So I'd encourage to look for alternatives.
Yes, I understand the ambitions of keeping some kind of window of opportunity open with the campaign for a fair sharing flat rate compensation system, and I'm not saying that that's bad. You shouldn't do that, but I say we shouldn't let those concepts be unquestioned. We should stand up and confront the questions of who is the authors that should be compensated, where do we draw the lines, and why, and how, and what different ethical views on culture is implicated in where we draw those lines. We got to keep that discussion alive instead of just relying to some common sense, because I think that can be dangerous.
Yeah, I also want to go back to this question, so where are the authors? And Alexei said, you're on the network or you're not on the network. And I think, for example, in classical music industry, the industry creates the attention by big marketing, and then on the other hand, it gets back the money. If we are if we are in another situation in the network, who will create the attention? And will a blogger who creates big attention get money from the musician who gets the money from the alternative compensation system, for example? So I think it gets really much more complicated if you just look at this example. And for this, it's really important to keep it a little bit open and look what is developing, because it is not one-dimensional. There's a lot of dimensions. It's a huge social process. And I think you're really right if you say we should not look for alternatives right now. We should have a little time. And we should live with this, that we say there is big pressure from the industry, and we don't have concepts with simple answers to say, oh, yeah, this is the concept we put against it.
Are there any more comments? If not, then this is perfect timing, because we have reached the end of our time. I would thank very much the four panelists for coming here and presenting their works, presenting their ideas, and I would thank the audience for being here. Now we have 10 minutes to get some sunlight. Thank you very much.